A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. A friend of his, let's call him Mike N, has found a shipping container on Facebook Marketplace for 5,000 shekels. It's currently sitting at a waste treatment facility. Pickup only. Delivery not included. Mike's plan is to have it dropped somewhere in the Negev desert, live in it off-grid, power everything with solar, and use a cellular modem for internet. He wants to know, purely pragmatically, how long he can stay self-sufficient and what failure modes he hasn't anticipated. Bureaucracy is off the table. We're just looking at whether this thing actually works.
I love this plan. I love it in the way you love a toddler announcing they're going to build a rocket ship out of cardboard boxes and yogurt lids. The ambition is magnificent. The physics is going to be less cooperative.
That's the most diplomatic this man is going to die I've ever heard.
I didn't say that. I said the physics would be uncooperative. Let's actually walk through this, because there's a genuine question here about off-grid self-sufficiency in extreme environments, and Mike has identified some real constraints. He just hasn't, I think, fully appreciated what the Negev does to things.
To things and to people.
To things and to people, yes. So let's start with the container itself. 5,000 shekels for a shipping container is actually reasonable. That's about $1,300. A standard 20-foot container weighs about 2.2 metric tons empty. A 40-foot is closer to 3.7. Mike didn't specify which size, but at that price, I'm guessing it's a 20-footer, maybe a high cube if he's lucky. The problem isn't the price. The problem is that it's at a waste treatment facility.
Which means it's not exactly a fresh-off-the-boat unit that spent its life hauling electronics in climate-controlled bliss.
A container from a waste treatment facility has probably been used for exactly that. Waste treatment. It may have held chemicals, organic waste, who knows what. The floor could be soaked in substances that off-gas for months. You'd need to inspect it thoroughly, and even then, you're rolling dice. But let's assume Mike does his due diligence, finds the container is structurally sound, and arranges delivery to some patch of Negev desert. Delivery alone on a flatbed truck for a distance of, say, 150 kilometers from wherever this facility is. That's another 3,000 to 5,000 shekels, easily. So his 5,000 shekel bargain is now 8,000 to 10,000 before he's even parked it.
He's parked it somewhere he can't move it from.
That's the first real failure mode he spotted himself. He acknowledges the delivery point can't be that remote. A flatbed truck needs a road, or at least a hard-packed track. It's not going to off-road into deep desert and gently place the container on a scenic dune. The driver will drop it at the end of the nearest accessible point, which means Mike's container is visible from whatever road or track services that area. It's not hidden. Anyone passing by will see a shipping container sitting in the desert and think one of two things. Either someone is building something, or someone has abandoned something. Neither is ideal for long-term undisturbed living.
His stealth shipping container home is basically a billboard.
A corrugated steel billboard that hits 50 degrees Celsius inside by 9 in the morning. Let's talk about the thermal situation, because this is where the Negev genuinely tries to kill you. Summer temperatures in the Negev regularly reach 40 to 45 degrees Celsius. The surface of an uninsulated steel container in direct sunlight can hit 70 degrees or higher. Inside, without ventilation or insulation, you're looking at ambient temperatures well above 50 degrees. That's not uncomfortable. That's medically dangerous. Heat stroke sets in when your core body temperature hits 40 degrees. You'd need continuous active cooling just to survive the daylight hours. Winter nights in the Negev can drop to near freezing, sometimes below. The same steel box that roasted you all summer now leaches every joule of heat out of your body. Insulation isn't optional. It's the difference between a shelter and a death trap. Mike would need to insulate the interior, which means framing out the walls, adding insulation panels, and covering them. That reduces the interior dimensions, which on a standard container are already about 2.3 meters wide. After insulation, you're down to maybe 2 meters of interior width.
Cozy is a word. The width of a generously sized coffin is a phrase.
We haven't even gotten to the solar question yet. Mike mentions using abundant solar energy, which is fair. The Negev gets some of the highest solar irradiance in the world, about 2,200 kilowatt hours per square meter per year. That's excellent. But converting that to usable power for air conditioning, a cellular modem, refrigeration, lighting, cooking, that requires a substantial system.
Walk me through the numbers. What's he actually need?
Let's be generous and assume he's running a minimal setup. A small air conditioning unit, and I mean small, like a 5,000 BTU window unit, draws about 500 to 600 watts when the compressor is running. In 40 degree heat inside an uninsulated metal box, it's going to run almost continuously during daylight. That's maybe 8 to 10 kilowatt hours per day just for cooling. Add a small refrigerator, another kilowatt hour. Lights, modem, charging devices, maybe another half kilowatt hour. Cooking, if he's using an electric hot plate, could add 2 to 3 kilowatt hours per day. So conservatively, he's looking at 12 to 15 kilowatt hours per day of consumption.
To generate 15 kilowatt hours a day from solar in the Negev.
With roughly 5 peak sun hours per day, he'd need about 3 kilowatts of solar panels just to meet daily demand. That's around 8 to 10 residential panels. But he also needs batteries, because the sun doesn't shine at night and the air conditioner, or at least a fan, needs to run then too. For overnight, he'd need at least 10 to 15 kilowatt hours of battery storage. A lithium iron phosphate battery of that capacity, something like a server rack battery, costs around $1,500 to $2,000 per 5 kilowatt hours. So for 15 kilowatt hours, he's looking at $4,500 to $6,000 just for batteries. The panels, inverter, charge controller, wiring, mounting hardware. You're easily at $10,000 to $12,000 total for the solar setup alone.
His 5,000 shekel container now needs about 40,000 shekels in solar equipment.
And that's before we discuss what happens when a sandstorm coats every panel in fine dust and output drops by 40% until he cleans them, which, by the way, he needs water for.
The thing the desert is famous for having in abundance.
The thing the desert is famous for not having. A single person needs about 3 to 4 liters of drinking water per day in extreme heat. For cooking, minimal hygiene, and cleaning those solar panels, you're probably at 10 to 15 liters per day minimum. That's 100 liters a week, 400 liters a month. Where is it coming from? Mike mentioned periodic supply runs to the nearest city, which means he's hauling water. A 400-liter water tank in a vehicle is not trivial. And if his supply run is delayed, vehicle breakdown, road closure, flash flood, which does happen in the Negev, he's on a very short clock.
Dehydration in 40-degree heat inside a metal box. That's not a failure mode. That's a death spiral.
It's a death spiral with a very short timeline. 72 hours without water in those conditions, and you're in serious trouble. But let's talk about the supply run itself, because Mike seems to envision this as a manageable periodic inconvenience. The Negev is not a suburb with a corner store. Depending on where he's placed, the nearest established city could be Be'er Sheva, Dimona, Mitzpe Ramon, or Eilat. If he's deep in the desert, we're talking a drive of an hour, 2 hours, maybe more, each way. That's a significant fuel cost for someone living off-grid on a budget. And he's doing this in a vehicle that presumably also needs fuel, maintenance, and insurance, all of which require money, which requires income, which presumably is why he needs the cellular modem.
The plan depends on reliable income earned via unreliable internet from an isolated location powered by a solar system that might fail in a container that's trying to cook him.
The cellular modem is another interesting failure point. The Negev has cellular coverage along major roads and near settlements, but once you're off the beaten path, coverage gets patchy fast. Mike would need to position his container within range of a tower, which further constrains how remote he can actually be. And even if he has signal, cellular internet in remote areas is not known for high speeds or reliability. If his income depends on, say, video calls or large file transfers, he's going to have a bad time.
What about wildlife? The Negev isn't empty.
It's very much not empty. You've got wolves, hyenas, various snakes, including the Palestinian viper, which is venomous, scorpions, including the Death Stalker, which has a potentially fatal sting, and a lot of rodents that will be extremely interested in any food he stores. A shipping container with a door that doesn't seal perfectly, and most don't, is an open invitation. And then there's the human wildlife issue. I wouldn't go straight to bandits, but a lone shipping container in the desert with signs of habitation is a curiosity at best and a target at worst. The Negev has Bedouin communities, military training zones, smugglers moving goods across the southern border, and just regular people who might stumble across it. Mike has no security. He has no way to secure the container beyond a padlock, and padlocks can be cut. If someone decides they want what's inside, or they want the container itself, or they just want to cause trouble, Mike is alone, unarmed presumably, and hours from help with no reliable way to call for it.
We've got heatstroke, dehydration, starvation, venomous wildlife, and potential human threats.
Sand is actually a serious problem. Fine desert dust gets into everything. Electronics, food, water, lungs. It's abrasive and corrosive. Solar panel efficiency drops. Ventilation fans clog. Any moving parts on doors or windows grind to a halt. Over months, the dust accumulation inside an imperfectly sealed container would be substantial. And breathing fine particulate dust constantly isn't great for your respiratory health.
The container slowly fills with dust while trying to cook or freeze you, depending on the hour. And your only defense is a solar system that's being gradually buried.
Let's talk about the psychological dimension, because Mike seems to be planning for physical survival, but not mental survival. The Negev is vast, empty, and silent in a way that urban dwellers cannot really prepare for. Days of complete solitude in a 2-meter-wide box with nothing but the hum of an air conditioner and the occasional scorpion for company. No shade except what the container provides. No running water. No immediate human contact. The sensory deprivation aspect alone can cause significant psychological strain within weeks. Hallucinations, paranoia, severe anxiety. These are documented effects of prolonged isolation in extreme environments.
Mike emerges 6 months later, having had a full psychotic break, convinced the scorpions are trying to negotiate rent.
The scorpions would be the least unreasonable landlords he's ever had. But seriously, the isolation is not a trivial factor. Even experienced solo desert dwellers typically have some form of regular contact, whether it's radio, satellite phone, or periodic visits. Mike's plan seems to assume that internet connectivity substitutes for human presence. It doesn't. Ask anyone who's done extended solo field work.
Let me ask you something. You mentioned the container might have held chemicals. At a waste treatment facility, what are we actually talking about?
Could be anything. Waste treatment facilities handle industrial runoff, sewage byproducts, chemical solvents, biological waste. A container used for storage or transport at such a facility might have residual contamination. Even if it's been cleaned, the cleaning might not have been thorough. You'd want to test the interior surfaces, especially the floor, for chemical residues. And the ventilation situation. Containers are designed to be sealed against weather during ocean transit. They don't breathe. Any off-gassing from residual chemicals, or from the insulation and construction materials Mike installs, is going to accumulate in a very small, very sealed space.
He could literally gas himself in his sleep.
Volatile organic compounds, carbon monoxide if he's using any combustion for cooking or heating, carbon dioxide buildup just from breathing in an inadequately ventilated space. These are real risks. Proper ventilation isn't just about comfort, it's about not suffocating. A shipping container needs active ventilation, which means more power draw, which means more solar panels, which means more cost.
Every solution creates a new problem.
That's basically the thesis of off-grid living in extreme environments. Every system you add to solve one problem creates two new failure modes. The air conditioner solves heat but needs power. The solar panels provide power but need cleaning and maintenance and degrade over time. The batteries store power but have limited cycle life and can fail catastrophically if not managed properly. The water storage solves dehydration but takes up space and can become contaminated. The cellular modem solves isolation but needs signal and power and can break.
Mike is the single point of failure for all of it. If he gets sick, if he injures himself, if he has a medical emergency, there's no backup.
That's the one that actually worries me most. Mike mentions periodic supply runs for medications, which suggests he has some ongoing medical needs. In the desert, a minor injury, a cut that gets infected, a sprained ankle, a bad case of food poisoning can become life-threatening very quickly when you're hours from medical care. Heat exhaustion can progress to heatstroke. Dehydration can cause kidney failure. A scorpion sting or snake bite requires anti-venom that Mike definitely doesn't have in his shipping container. Even something as simple as appendicitis becomes a potential death sentence.
What's the actual self-sufficiency timeline? How long before one of these failure modes catches up with him?
If everything goes perfectly, and I mean perfectly, he's got his solar system dialed in, his water storage is adequate, his insulation is effective, his ventilation is working, no wildlife breaches the container, no human threats materialize, his internet stays reliable, his vehicle doesn't break down, and his health holds up. He could probably manage a few months. Maybe 3 to 6. Beyond that, the cumulative effect of minor problems starts compounding. The psychological toll mounts. Something breaks that he can't fix without parts or expertise he doesn't have.
If things don't go perfectly?
If things don't go perfectly, he's in trouble within weeks. A single sandstorm that clogs his ventilation or reduces his solar output for a few days could cascade. A water container that develops a leak. A bout of food poisoning that leaves him too weak to maintain his systems. A visit from someone who decides his container looks interesting. Any one of these could end the experiment, and not necessarily with Mike walking away under his own power.
The honest answer to how long can he stay self-sufficient is somewhere between not long and not long enough to make the math work.
The math is the thing. Mike is trying to solve a housing affordability problem, which is a real and serious issue in Israel. But the shipping container in the desert isn't the housing solution. It's an extremely expensive, extremely dangerous camping trip. The 5,000 shekels for the container is the cheapest part of the whole endeavor, and the ongoing costs of water, fuel, equipment maintenance, and medical risk far exceed whatever he'd save on rent.
Let's say Mike hears all of this and says, "Fine, but I'm still doing it. What should I actually do to not die?"
That's the right question. If Mike is determined, and I respect determination, there are things he can do to mitigate the worst risks. First, he needs to think about concealment and security. The container shouldn't be visible from any road or track. If he can't get it delivered somewhere hidden, he needs to figure out how to move it after delivery. That's not trivial for a 2-ton steel box, but it's not impossible either.
How do you secretly move a shipping container deeper into the desert?
This is where it gets creative. If he can't afford a crane and a heavy haul truck, which he almost certainly can't, he could look at a system of rollers and a winch. Old school Egyptians moving stone blocks approach. Steel pipes as rollers, a heavy duty electric winch anchored to something solid or to buried dead man anchors, and a lot of patience. He could move the container a few meters per hour, over several days, to a location that's not visible from the delivery point. It's absurdly labor intensive, but it's physically possible. The delivery truck drops the container at point A. Over the next week, Mike inchworms it to point B, half a kilometer away, behind a ridge or in a wadi where it's not visible from any approach.
The thing that fills with water during flash floods.
Yes, don't put it in a wadi. That would be bad. A ridge, then, or just a depression that isn't a drainage channel. The point is, he needs topographic concealment. He also needs to camouflage the container. A shiny steel box in the desert stands out for kilometers. Painting it in desert tones, tans, browns, muted ochres, helps. So does adding a shade structure above it, which also helps with the thermal problem. A simple frame with a reflective tarp suspended above the container, with an air gap, can reduce interior temperatures by 10 degrees or more. It also breaks up the distinctive rectangular silhouette from above and from a distance.
He's painting his container to blend in and building a tarp roof over it. At what point does this stop being a housing solution and start being a covert operations base?
I think it stopped being a housing solution somewhere around waste treatment facility pickup only. But if we're going full pragmatic, he should also think about an emergency cache. A buried or hidden supply of water, food, and medical supplies separate from the main container in case the container is compromised or he needs to leave quickly. And a satellite messenger, something like a Garmin inReach or a spot device. That can send an SOS with his location, even when there's no cellular signal. That's a few $100 and a monthly subscription, and it's the difference between life and death in a medical emergency.
What about the Bedouin question? You mentioned communities in the Negev. That's not a hypothetical.
It's not, and I want to be careful here. The Bedouin and the Negev are not a threat by default. They're people who have lived in this desert for centuries and know it better than Mike ever will. But Mike is proposing to place an unpermitted, concealed dwelling on land that may be subject to competing claims, near communities that have their own complex relationships with the state and with land use. If his container is discovered, the reaction could range from curiosity to hostility to a demand that he leave. He has no legal standing, no community relationships, and no way to assert any claim to the spot he's occupying. He's a squatter on a very exposed piece of land.
If someone decides the container should be theirs?
A shipping container is a valuable object. It can be sold, repurposed, stripped for parts. If someone with a truck and the means to move it decides they want it, Mike's options are limited. He can't physically defend it against multiple people. He can't call the police and explain why he's living in an unpermitted container on state land. He's in a very weak position. This is the kind of scenario where having relationships with nearby communities, whoever they are, becomes essential. A lone outsider with no connections is vulnerable in ways that are hard to overstate.
He needs to befriend the neighbors. The neighbors who may or may not want him there.
Ideally, before he drops a shipping container on what might be their traditional grazing land, yes. But that requires social skills, cultural knowledge, and time, all of which are harder to acquire than solar panels.
Let's go back to the container itself for a moment. You mentioned insulation. What's the actual process for making a shipping container habitable in the Negev?
You'd need to create a thermal break between the steel skin and the interior living space. The standard approach is to frame the interior with wood or steel studs, fill the cavity with closed cell spray foam or rigid foam insulation boards, and cover with plywood or drywall. For the Negev specifically, you'd want at least 50 to 75 millimeters of insulation on all surfaces, including the floor and ceiling. The floor is particularly important because the container will radiate heat upward from the ground. You'd also need to cut openings for ventilation, high on one end, low on the other, to create a cross breeze, and install screened, sealable vents. The doors need weather stripping. Any windows you cut need to be double glazed and shaded. This is not a weekend project. This is weeks of work requiring tools, materials, and skills that Mike may or may not have.
All of this adds weight and reduces interior space.
Insulation materials, framing lumber, plywood, vents, windows, door seals, paint. You're looking at several thousand shekels more. The container is the cheap part. The conversion is where the money goes.
To recap, Mike's 5,000 shekel bargain container will cost him somewhere north of 50,000 shekels by the time it's delivered, insulated, powered, and equipped. And even then, it might kill him within weeks.
That's the pessimistic summary, yes. The optimistic summary is that with careful planning, significant investment, and a clear-eyed understanding of the risks, someone could live in a shipping container in the Negev for extended periods. People do live off-grid in deserts around the world. It's not impossible. It's just that the gap between I saw a cheap container on Facebook Marketplace and I am sustainably living off-grid in an extreme environment is about the size of the Negev itself.
Mike's plan, as described, is somewhere in the foothills of that gap.
He's still in the parking lot of the visitor center looking at a postcard of the foothills. But I appreciate the ambition. The housing situation in Israel is difficult, especially for young people. The impulse to find an alternative path is completely understandable. I just don't want Mike to die of heat stroke in a chemical-contaminated steel box while trying to save on rent.
That's going on a t-shirt.
Don't die of heat stroke in a chemical-contaminated steel box. The new single from DJ Herman Poppleberry.
Covering the covers.
But look, here's what I'd actually tell Mike if he were sitting here. The shipping container idea isn't fundamentally insane. People convert containers into homes all over the world. The problem is the location and the isolation. If he could place that container on a piece of land with road access, water, and grid power, even a small plot in a rural area, the whole equation changes. It becomes a viable tiny home project. It's the combination of extreme environment, total isolation, and minimal resources that makes this particular plan so precarious.
The failure mode isn't the container, it's the desert.
The desert is the multiplier. It takes every small problem, a power fluctuation, a water shortage, a minor injury, and turns it into a potential catastrophe. The desert doesn't care about your plans. The desert doesn't care about your budget. The desert has been there for millions of years, and it will be there after your container has rusted into a brown stain on the rocks.
That's almost poetic.
The desert brings out the poet in me. Also, the pediatrician who really doesn't want to read about a foreign national found deceased in a shipping container.
What about the hostage scenario?
I'm sorry, what?
You mentioned Bedouin communities, potential hostility, a lone container in the desert. If someone decides Mike's presence is a problem, or that Mike himself is a valuable bargaining chip, He's in a hostage situation with no leverage and no rescue timeline.
I was trying not to go full thriller novel, but yes, that's a theoretical risk. Isolated individuals in disputed areas are vulnerable to all kinds of exploitation. It's not the most likely failure mode, but it's not impossible either. The broader point is that Mike's physical security is entirely dependent on nobody deciding to harm him, because he has no defenses and no backup. In a city, there are neighbors, police, passers-by. In a concealed shipping container in the desert, there's nobody.
The self-sufficiency is an illusion. He's not self-sufficient, he's just isolated.
Self-sufficiency implies resilience, redundancy, the ability to handle problems internally. What Mike is describing is isolation, which is the opposite. Isolation means every problem is yours alone. Every resource must be brought in. Every failure cascades because there's no buffer. True self-sufficiency in a desert environment requires community, or at least proximity to community. The Bedouin didn't survive in the Negev for centuries as lone individuals in steel boxes. They survived as interconnected communities with deep knowledge of the land, shared resources, and mutual support.
The real advice is, don't do it alone.
Or, don't do it in the desert. Or, don't do it in a container from a waste treatment facility. Or ideally, don't do it in that specific combination of choices. But if Mike is going to do it anyway, and some people just need to learn by doing. At minimum, get the satellite messenger, build the shade structure, cache emergency water, and tell someone exactly where you are and when to expect to hear from you. That's the difference between an adventure that goes wrong and a tragedy that nobody discovers for months.
Maybe don't buy the container until you've actually visited the waste treatment facility and seen what you're getting.
That seems like a very low bar, and yet I'm not confident it's been cleared.
To answer the prompt directly, self-sufficiency duration, under ideal conditions with proper preparation, maybe 3 to 6 months before cumulative problems become unmanageable. Under realistic conditions, with the level of preparation Mike seems to have, probably measured in weeks.
The failure modes he hasn't anticipated include thermal overload, dust contamination of all systems, water logistics collapse, psychological deterioration, wildlife intrusion, human threat vectors, medical emergency without rescue capability, chemical off-gassing, ventilation failure, cellular connectivity, unreliability, and the general cascading nature of small problems in isolated environments.
Most of them. He's anticipated almost none of the failure modes.
He anticipated that the delivery point wouldn't be remote. Give him credit for that one. He spotted one failure mode. It's a start.
Like a toddler who realizes the cardboard rocket ship might need tape.
Now he just needs to realize. It also needs a heat shield, life support, navigation, and a ground crew.
I hope Mike writes back after he's had a chance to think about all this. I want to know which failure mode he finds most surprising.
My money is on the dust. Nobody ever respects the dust until their lungs are full of it and their solar panels are outputting 12% of rated capacity.
Mine is the scorpions. People think they're prepared for scorpions. They are never prepared for scorpions.
Nobody is prepared for finding a death stalker in their shoe at 3 in the morning.
Now Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, chemists studying dye absorption in Surinamese bauxite processing discovered that pigment particles distributed across filter membranes followed a probability distribution that appeared to violate the law of large numbers, until someone realized the particles were not independent events, but were clumping together in humid conditions, creating a paradox where the aggregate behaved unpredictably even as individual particle counts converged toward their expected mean.
The dye was cheating at statistics.
The dye was clustering. It's always clustering.
That was unsettling.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. Find more episodes at myweirdprompts.com. For Korn, I'm Herman Pavelberry.
I'm Korn. Don't buy containers from waste treatment facilities.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.